And of course, this terrorist scourge is their work, and we must stand up to them. Absolutely. Let's be intolerant of intolerance. Absolutely, I'm with the Prime Minister on that one. And perhaps he'd like to comment about the British attempt to overthrow the government of Assad through military means, and who was involved in it. Did he know anything about it? Because if he did, then maybe he's one of the ones that need to go on trial.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, as I said at the top of the hour, it's a decade, beginning of next week, since the 7/7 London bombings with three tube trains and a number 30 bus. So, Martin, have the lessons been learnt, do you think, in those 10 years?
Well, as you know, Tony, we were suspicious at the time of what was happening, and we looked into it as much as we could. And I'm afraid that there are just as many other of these attacks, the Bologna bombing, the Piazza Fontana attack in 1969. There's all sorts of evidence that suggests that this is another staged event. For example, one of the most killer things that was discovered through citizen investigation was that the train the bombers supposedly caught from Luton that morning, and therefore placed them in the right times and places to plant the bombs, didn't run. And the government didn't even bother to check. And eventually they had to admit, the train didn't run. So that means that the whole narrative of what happened on that day is simply wrong. Can't be right. They can't possibly be in the times and places that the government claims that they were. Now, it's very hard for ordinary people to get their heads around the idea that the government might orchestrate such an attack. Less problematic for people who live in Belfast, I suspect, than those who live in Bristol. But the reality is that that's a perfectly legitimate suspicion. It might be wrong, but we've got all sorts of reason to think that that might be the case. And I'm afraid the police, I spoke to the police at Birmingham Central Mosque a few years ago, as you know, Tony. Many police officers, Muslim police officers in particular, do understand what we're talking about here. I'm afraid the Western intelligence services are already way out of control. The last thing they need is more powers.
Well, let's go back to 2005, 10 years ago, and one of the first little bits of evidence here that something was wrong on the London Underground, we go to the communications between the staff in the control rooms of the London Underground.
Yeah, but it's only one explosion though, isn't it? Hello there, Vince.
Hello.
Right, I've just spoken to Darren. It looks like there's been one explosion on, near or under a train at Liverpool Street on the Met.
That's
right. But it also, we've lost signals in the Tower Hill area and the Whitechapel area. So it could be an HT main cable.
Yeah.
So we're not looking at an act of aggression at the moment.
Right, okay.
Where are you?
I'm at Earl's Court in my office.
If you pop up the control room, you'll find they're in deep shit.
All right, I'm heading there now.
Okay, mate.
Okay, speak to you shortly. Bye.
Sorry for the swearing there, but I think I hope you understand that this is an important bit of evidence that we're hearing. Martin, they initially thought it was power failures. That's quite normal because if a train derails or something, then it actually causes a short circuit.
Yes, well, what's interesting is that Benjamin Netanyahu, the finance minister of Israel at the time, was in London that morning, and he did not go to a meeting at Liverpool Street because he had a warning. The Jerusalem Post phoned up the embassy and said, oh, we've just heard there's been bomb attacks in Britain. Is Netanyahu all right? And they said, no, he's fine. We had a warning beforehand and we didn't go out that day. Now, so at the time when this is happening, where they're thinking this is a usual electrical failure, the Israelis already know that it's a bomb attack and are not taking their boy out of the house.
Well, in the press report you're talking about, Associated Press from Jerusalem, Amy Teeble wrote that report on the day. She actually says an anonymous spokesperson, but I've spoken to David Pratt from the Scottish Sunday Herald, who's their foreign affairs editor. He says actually the spokesperson who was saying it on the day is Dan Shaham from the Israeli embassy. And David pressed him on the warning, and he said actually the Israeli embassy in London went into a high state of alert between 6 and 7 a.m. that morning.
Indeed, and that doesn't mean they did it, but it means that they knew something was going to happen, let's put it that way. But it doesn't mean they didn't do it either.
So if one person gets a warning, why don't they pass that on?
Well, the way the Israeli embassy attempted to finesse it in the end was by saying that they'd had a warning from the Metropolitan Police. But they didn't have any warning from the Metropolitan Police because, as you can see, there was no knowledge in the British police structure of what was happening, or not that we know of.
Moving on a little bit, and after the attacks, one of the first reports, certainly as far as I know, the first audio report, came from The Guardian's Mark Honigsbaum, who was at the scene of the Edgware Road bomb, and he'd been speaking to people as they'd been coming out from the tube station from the destroyed train.
The London Hilton Hotel opposite Edgware Road station, where we believe there was an explosion this morning under the carriage of a train. I've been speaking to survivors all morning.
I'm just going to stop that there for a second, Martin, and replay it, because he says something quite interesting right at the start of that report. He says, under the carriage of a train.
That was the point. I mean, the original story, as it came out, was that the bombs were under the trains. And if you actually look at photographs of the damage, they show the floors blown out and the windows blown out, yeah, and the floor blown up. Yeah,
so the other thing is, of course, the train was derailed, so that does suggest that something might have lifted the train
up, indeed.
Rather than pressed it down
indeed.
Onto the tracks.
Now, the way this, if you want to, we'll perhaps go on because.
Well, let's have a listen again to that, and then you can, you know, listeners, you can listen out for him. Actually, he actually does say under the carriage. So let's have a listen again to Mark Honigsbaum's report from the top.
This is Mark Honigsbaum reporting from the London Hilton Hotel opposite Edgware Road station, where we believe there was an explosion this morning under the carriage of a train. I've been speaking to survivors all morning. People were evacuated, first of all, to Marks and Spencer's beside the underground, and then across the road to the London Hilton, where there are some people in very, very bad injuries. There was a woman who got cuts and burns to her face and is being wrapped from head to neck in bandages. There's people with blood cuts. But, I mean, the main thing is people are extremely shook up still. What seems to have happened is that sometime around 9:30 this morning, passengers in a train from Edgware Road travelling to Paddington, they'd just left Edgware Road station when suddenly they felt they heard a massive explosion. And some passengers described how the tiles, the covers on the floor of the train suddenly flew up, raised up, and the next thing they know, there was another almighty crash, which they now believe was a train travelling in the opposite direction, hitting their train, which had been derailed by this explosion. The next thing that happened was everything went black, there was thick smoke, and one passenger said to me that they heard this terrible, terrible screaming coming from the front of a train. It was a man's voice, and he was just saying, "Someone help me, please help me." This young woman, Sarah 23, said that it was one of the most chilling sounds she'd ever heard. Now, this is unconfirmed at this point, but they later heard that this man had had very, very bad injuries to his legs. And while she and other survivors were being held in Marks and Spencer's, they also heard that there may have been one or possibly two fatalities. As I said, that's unconfirmed at the moment, but that's what they were being told. The woman who was sitting in the hotel being bandaged told how the first thing that happened was that just a massive fireball, she said, came towards her. The next thing to know, you know, she was burnt all over her face and the carriage was full of smoke. I haven't been able to get much more from her. Her name is Davinia. She worked in Canary Wharf. Presumably she was on her way there, like many Londoners were this morning, when this happened.
That's Mark Honigsbaum speaking on 7/7 itself, Martin. The other thing he says there is that the tiles on the floor of the train flew up, raised up.
Indeed, which is not what you'd expect from a rucksack bomb being carried by a bomber, would it? And also, of course, why would people get injuries on their legs from that? You'd expect injuries on their heads or their upper torso, wouldn't you? That's another of the anomalies.
Also, it does seem to be some very powerful type of explosive.
Yes, well, I was just going to mention that. The idea that these people created explosives from TATP, which is essentially, you know, peroxide that you use to dye your hair. There was a French police officer who was at Scotland Yard on the day, and he came out to brief his people, and he said, "We understand that the explosive was C4 explosive," which is very worrying because that's professional military level explosive, NATO standard issue. But of course, what happens in these events, as you well know, Tony, is that various things come out in the immediate aftermath, which are then swept under the carpet. So the fact that the French policeman briefed his own people saying we think it's serious, the explosive used, has never, they've never been able to nail it down. Eventually, of course, they raided this place in Leeds, which they said was the bomb factory. Now, this starts to make me think that the police are to some extent implicated in all of this, because the evidence suggests that that was not a rucksack bomb carried by an amateur. That sounds like a serious piece of sabotage carried out probably by somebody from the SAS, dare I suggest it? People in Belfast would understand what I'm saying to people in Bristol.
One of the big controversies was the Peter Powers terror drills, which he says, this is a guy from Visor Consultants, he did the rounds of most of the media in the Western world talking about a terror drill that he did at the same three tube stations on the same day. Now, I did a little bit of maths and worked out that the chances of him telling the truth, saying that that was nothing to do with the actual attacks, is about 8 billion to 1, Martin.
Well, yes. I mean, and the way these things work, what we know about how NATO terrorism works, and there are plenty of experts on it, like Daniel Ganser in Switzerland is the top academic on this. The way these things work is that you have drills going on of terrorist attacks, like the one in London that's going to take place next week. And then, lo and behold, in the middle of the drill, there is a terrorist attack. And that's because the terrorist attack is part of the drill and then it goes live. So it's quite possible. One of the theories about the bombers is that they were part of an MI5 drill. Well, that's what they thought.
Now, let's have a listen to one of the more obscure recordings from the Canadian Broadcasting Service of Peter Power here, where he talks about this as a spooky coincidence.
The World Conference on Disaster Management. It's the biggest conference on disaster management in the world. Adrian Gordon is the executive director of the Canadian Centre for Emergency Preparedness, and Peter Power is the managing director of a consulting firm based in London that specializes in crisis management. Thanks, both of you, for being here. Peter, let's start with you. We've heard something quite extraordinary. Could be a coincidence or not, that your firm, on the very day that the bombs went off in London, were running an exercise simulating three bombs going off in the very same tube stations that they went on. How did this happen? Coincidence, or were you acting on information that you knew?
I don't think we can say that we had some special insight to the terrorist network, otherwise I'd be under arrest myself. The truth of it is...
But it is a coincidence.
It's a coincidence, and it's a spooky coincidence. Our scenario was very similar. It wasn't totally identical, but it was based on bombs going off to the time, the location, all this sort of stuff. But it wasn't an accident in the sense that London has a history of bombs. And the reason why our emergency services did so well and prepared probably better than any other city in the world, sadly, they have to be. So it wasn't exactly rocket science or totally out of the pale to come up with that scenario. Unusual though it did, so we had to stop the exercise and go into real time, and it worked very well. Although there was a few seconds when the audience didn't realise whether it was real or not.
Sounds a bit spooky, doesn't it? He's saying spooky coincidence, and all of a sudden the audience weren't sure if the terror attack was real or not, Martin?
Yeah, well, some people who listen to Peter Power presume that he must have had some knowledge. I don't presume that at all. The way these things work is that you have a terror drill with people like him engaging in practicing what they do in such circumstances, and then other people inside the structure actually press a button, as it were, and make the actual thing actually happen.
And what that does, of course, is it means that people aren't necessarily prepared to actually react. They think it's part of a drill.
Well, that's what happened on 9/11, where they were actually running drills that day of planes being hijacked and crashed into buildings. So, and they'd actually created a situation where they got false radar blips. And there's even a recording of somebody saying to somebody, is this real or is this the drill? And of course, that's how you carry these attacks out if you are
now,
a terrorist.
At the time,
and I mean a real terrorist. We're talking about NATO intelligence services.
At the time, Peter Power didn't want to talk about who'd commissioned the drill, because obviously that was one of the questions people were asking. It turned out later it was a company called Reed Elsevier, who are a publisher. But the other thing that they do some military publishing, but they also were the company that for many years did the event organising for the XL Arms Fair, which is the biggest arms fair in Britain.
Well, Tony, you know what a lot of people listening to this will be saying? But this is just conspiracy theory. But in actual fact, the facts are facts are facts. They just are.
That wasn't the only drill, though, because I spoke to a former Ministry of Defence police. He was doing software for the Ministry of Defence police and a civil servant. And he saw nuclear, chemical and biological drills going on in London the same morning.
Well, my name's Paul Lewis, and at the time I was actually working on the NHS project, modernising their systems. And at the time we were actually putting some systems into the UCLH hospital, which is just around the corner from Warren Street. basically, the building we were in, it's all got glass fronts, and it's basically just, you're able to see out all the time. It's not like a case of a window. The whole walls were basically glass, basically, up to a certain extent anyway. And I remember very briefly the morning of the bombings, actually looking out the window and seeing police. And this is prior to the bombings actually going off. And they're all on the bridge, going over the main circular roads going around London, or where Warren Street is. And it looked to me as if they were actually doing some sort of exercise anyway. Just my assumption they were doing an exercise, but some of them were actually dressed up in sort of chemical, biological protection. Well, I didn't actually think about it at the time, because it was just a quick glimpse out the window, noticed it, and then walked away. And it wasn't until afterwards, then the whole bombing stuff went on, and all the police sirens and all the rest of the stuff. But it wasn't until later on, when I was sort of sifting through the alternative information about 7/7, that I came across the fact that that was reported they were doing these chemical, biological exercises.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? So the Peter Powers wasn't the only drill going on that day.
No, the way you do it is there were on 9/11 there were lots and lots of different drills being run, including a NORAD drill, which had taken virtually all the US Air Force to Canada to pretend to fight the Russian invasion over the Arctic, which meant that their scramble, you know, if you think about it, this is the most heavily defended airspace in the world. I mean, it's certainly the space around the Pentagon, which has missiles which shoot anything that comes anywhere near it, and for an hour and a half planes fly around in US airspace and are not intercepted by a single fighter.
One of the other aspects to the 7/7 bombings was absolutely no CCTV pictures have been released of any of these bombers actually where they were supposed to be. That is the buses or the tubes actually getting onto them or on them. We're told that such footage just simply didn't exist. Now, if you go down the underground or get on any bus, you'll find cameras absolutely everywhere. And on that bus, there's Daniel Obachicki, who wrote a book called The Fourth Bomb. He says he was on the number 30 bus, and he says he actually thought he identified who the bomber was, and he certainly wasn't this chap Hasib Hussein. So let's hear now from Daniel.
I stood downstairs and waited for people to go past me, and they were all asking questions. They were as lost as me and saying, does this bus go here? Does this bus go King's Cross? Does this bus go everywhere? And then no one fit in the description of that guy. I think his name is Hasib Hussein. He's some big hefty guy with a big massive rucksack. Now, I was standing there, people were brushing past me. I never saw no big hench guy with a rucksack go past me. That's it. Now, people might like to speculate that he was already on board the bus from a previous bus stop. I mean, that's something which someone has tried to suggest. I actually saw an individual with a grey, light grey top and a dark grey two-tone rucksack, brown hair, who was sitting upstairs. He had a rucksack. Then he came downstairs. I'm standing downstairs. I'm saying, why is the guy sitting upstairs, then sitting downstairs? To me, I came to the conclusion that he must have been the bomber. He must have planted something upstairs, then sat downstairs. And obviously, he got off in the minute before the bomb went off, when the bus driver opened the doors for no apparent reason when there was no bus stop.
Well, he sounds like an interesting chap, so I don't know if you can you just give us as full a description if you can of what he was
doing. He was a European male in his mid-20s, brown mousy hair. I remember his water kind of showerproof top. It was light grey, and the two-tone rucksack. And that's all I really remember of him. He did look at me hesitantly a couple of times, and I looked back at him. I thought he was just another lost kind of person. I thought that's what the reason he was looking at me. And he got off. He was actually the very last person to get off that bus before the driver shut the door, and then the bomb went off 60 seconds or so later.
See, now, many people might speculate that how come you can remember so much about this? Most people, when they're on the bus, if you were to tell them who went upstairs, who went downstairs, they would remember nothing.
I remember this like it was yesterday. I mean, for some reason, I was standing there. I was really thinking, I shouldn't be on this bus. I should be on the bus in front. That's why I was getting a bit agitated there, and I was seeing what was going on, the delays, and I was looking out the window and saying, why the hell is this bus getting nowhere? So when you're in that state, looking at things and questioning everything, that's how I am as a person, I suppose. I mean, I saw this guy, and the thing which made me ask questions was, why did the bus driver stop the bus when nobody had rung the bell and open the middle doors and not open the front doors? That's what he did, and that's quite a few people got off from upstairs, a few people from downstairs as well, and then the very last person was this European man with brown hair, a light grey rainproof top, and a two-tone dark grey rucksack. So to me, that speaks volumes, because you have to ask yourself, things normally happen naturally. You ring the bell, bus driver stops, you get off. The bus driver doesn't just stop, open the doors, and no one rang the bell, okay? That's all I'm saying. That was an irregularity which drew my attention.
Just before the bomb went off, Martin. Also, there hasn't really been any proper kind of judicial inquiry, which is one of the things that the families are rather annoyed about. And one of the reasons that even the families don't want to have a public inquiry is because of something which is explained in the internet documentary called Ludicrous Diversion. And we have a little clip from that now.
The terrorists cannot take away our freedom or change our way of life. Only our own elected leaders can do that. And they are. As if public inquiries were already not pointless enough, a recent piece of legislation now guarantees that they will never be anything other than a charade. On June the 7th, 2005, exactly 1 month before the London bombings, the Inquiries Act became law. Under this new act, any inquiry will be controlled by the relevant government minister, who is empowered to block public scrutiny of state actions. This inexplicable change to the way inquiries are run was openly criticised by the Law Society of England and Amnesty International, who stated that the new act means that any inquiry will be controlled by the executive. Obviously, the one thing you don't want from a supposedly unbiased investigation. The Canadian judge Peter Corey stated, "It seems to me that the proposed new act would make a meaningful inquiry impossible. The commissions would be working in an impossible situation. The minister, the actions of whose ministry was to be reviewed by the public inquiry, would have the authority to thwart the efforts of the inquiry at every step. It really creates an intolerable Alice in Wonderland situation." The chairman of the US Joint Committee on Human Rights, Congressman Chris Smith, declared that the bill pending before the British Parliament should be named the Public Inquiry's Cover-Up Bill. So if this new act makes inquiries so pointless and so easy to control, the question is why Blair, Clark and the rest of them have seemingly done their best to prevent one happening. This is an issue that encompasses the very nature of democracy, the basis of government, and the role of the police and the media in our society today. An objective, unbiased analysis of what occurred on the 7th of July 2005 must be made. And a rational debate about how we, as a society, are going to respond to it, must be allowed to take place. We owe it to all 56 people who died that day. We owe it to their families. And we owe it to ourselves.
Now, that's from the internet documentary Ludicrous Diversion, Martin, that came out literally about 6 months after the attacks, just before the end, around about Christmas 2005. And what they're effectively saying is there needs to be a proper kind of independent inquiry, not a public inquiry, because Theresa May would control a public inquiry.
Well, the Pat Finucane Centre in Northern Ireland wants an inquiry into collusion and terrorism by the British military and intelligence services. And there was a very good Panorama documentary on BBC not long ago, the BBC occasionally gets things right, where the head of the police ombudswoman for Northern Ireland, Nuala O'Loan, said, look, well, as far as we can see, the British Army are responsible for hundreds of deaths here because they were orchestrating the Loyalist terror campaign and infiltrating the IRA campaign. Now, in other words, the idea that the state wouldn't do something like this, certainly not in Britain, is simply wrong. We don't know what happened on 7/7. we need to know a lot more than we do.
Well, the only judicial process that's really happened, other than disclosure through different trials, is the inquests. Now, the trouble is, an inquest, I think it was Lady Justice Hallett opened the inquest, and it took place in 2010, 5 years after the attacks. An inquest is designed for one single death.
Yes. So, in other words, I mean, the Pat Finucane consensus,
and also her inquest had no jury. She decided there was no need to have a jury.
Indeed, and of course, the whole idea of having so-called suicide bombers who were all dead means that we don't even have to have a police investigation. And I would put it to people: what kind of police investigation is it when it's people like us who gumshoe round to Connex Rail in Luton and finally get Connex Rail to say, "Well, we thought the police would be coming to talk to us. That train didn't run that morning." And people think they've seen CCTV of the bombers on the train. They saw CCTV of the bombers on the dry run the previous week. Now,
yes, and the BBC actually removed the timestamp from that deliberately.
Yes, they did. And therefore, people think they've seen these guys getting on the train. And in actual fact, they haven't, because that train didn't run. As in actual fact, the Home Secretary, John Reid, had to admit to the House of Commons, yes, we got that wrong, the train didn't run. Now, what sort of police inquiry is it where you don't establish those basic facts about the day, whether the train they were on ran? That's because we've already got a narrative, they did it, blah, 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 we need more security forces, powers, etc. And in actual fact, there's been no proper police investigation of it at all.
Of course, for the worst, other than the victims themselves that died on the day, is for the families of relatives. And when the inquest or inquests were started in 2010, this is what the families had to say through a press conference convened by their lawyer.
We have questions that need answering. We were allowed to submit some questions to the Intelligence and Security Committee, but those questions were not answered. Our role now will be one of answering questions only. Which we will do willingly, but our questions are not going to be answered. Again, we've been shunted aside by officialdom. It's very important that we all remember that the inquests are for the families and the loved ones of those who died. But this is our only voice. We've been led to believe that this would be an opportunity for us to have a voice, and now we don't.
That's because it was ruled that the families would have no legal representation at the inquest, Martin.
Well, it's a cover-up, isn't it? And the other important point to make is that Haroon Rashid Aswat, who was named by the police as the mastermind of the bombing, because he'd been on the phone to all of the supposed alleged bombers the week before.
He was Abu Jaroon, Finsbury Park Mosque guy,
yes,
wasn't he? Abu Hamza's man.
Yes, he was Abu Hamza's second in command, but according to the US intelligence services, he was working for MI6. And every time they tried to arrest him, MI6 got him sprung, even as he travelled around the world in places like Afghanistan and South Africa.
He's now actually been extradited.
Yes,
so even the families, if they wanted to go through a private prosecution, couldn't get him. He's out of Britain's
legal jurisdiction. He was one of the very few people in Britain who were held under administrative detention so that he couldn't be questioned by any police officer. And then he went mad, apparently, and was sent to Broadmoor. Now, the fact is that if he was the mastermind, and I don't think he was the mastermind, he's another agent, then the police should have interviewed him. But they didn't, because he went mad and was put in administrative detention. But, of course, the Americans had already named him as an MI6 double agent. Now, can people see what's going on here? The mastermind, as named by the Metropolitan Police, is an MI6 double agent, and he hasn't been prosecuted. Why is that?
Graham Fawkes, he lost his 22-year-old son in the attacks, and he was also one of the people who had his phone hacked by the News of the World to add insult to injury, and he was interviewed by a local BBC channel up in Yorkshire.
David was my son, you know, he was 22. It was his first time ever to London, first time ever on the Underground, and he found himself stood next to Siddiqui Khan. And we've had nearly 4 years now of no answers to lots of very important questions. The government have stonewalled everything. It's been very, very difficult, and continues to be very, very difficult.
I think you're particularly angry that the government and security services did have surveillance on the London bombers, but didn't act. That's something that really grates with you, for obvious reasons.
We were told at the time by the government that the four bombers were clean skins. They were completely unknown to the intelligence services, that the attack had come out of the blue, and therefore there was no way to stop it. But the evidence in this trial, that's been presented in this trial, proves that to be completely untrue. the security service had a huge file on Mohammed Siddiqui Khan, and I can go into that chapter and verse, about how he'd been to Pakistan repeatedly, how he'd been to Cumbria, how he'd been to North Wales. The police, the intelligence community had this huge file. So I say that the fact that their job is to collect information, is to collate it, is to analyse it and to act. That didn't happen, and my son died, so that needs to be looked into.
Can I ask you that this next stage for you then, an independent inquiry, yes. Not a public inquiry, no. An independent inquiry, yes. Is vital for you?
Well, it's very important for me and the other members of the families, but the systems and the processes that were in place then, which patently failed to prevent the bombers, are still the same systems and processes that are in place now, and the government have chosen to maintain that status quo. And I think that's really worrying. And it's also important that we find out why the government told such untruths.
Graham, thank you very much indeed.
Graham Fawkes there, who's lost his 22-year-old son. I'm also joined by Fran Anderson. Hi, Fran, who knows a bit about Mohammed Siddiqui Khan.
Hi there, Tony. Yes, Mohammed Siddiqui Khan and Shehzad Tanweer, two of the alleged bombers, were trustees of the ICRA charity bookshop and youth outreach in Leeds. This was a centre distributing extremist Islamic media, and the man running ICRA was Martin McDade, an ex-special boat service soldier. He supposedly converted to Islam, and Newsnight reported that a youth worker at ICRA called Mark Hargreaves says that McDade had a hidden agenda, as he was deliberately grooming young Muslim men and was espousing the most extremist Muslim agenda.
Okay, time to sign off now. Time for the Murdoch News at 7, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights. A sister show, Dialects, on Tuesdays at noon. More about the London bombings. Thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to the show. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Join us for the Politics Show at 5 next week.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the Queen's led a minute's silence for the victims of the gun attack in Tunisia last week.